So, Steve, we've come to the end of our first series of Not Enough Champagne, and I can't help but thinking that we've chosen a really bad time to start a political podcast that's based on reasonableness and moderation.
Yeah, there's a number of events which certainly go to the other end of the debate on that, yeah.
So, what we're going to finish off this first series by is by asking the very reasonable question, are we all doomed? Steve, are we?
I don't think so. I mean, things are a bit bumpy at the moment, but it's not Armageddon.
Shall I give you the case for the prosecution, the reasons why we're doomed?
Go for it, and then I can tell them apart.
Okay, so I reckon we've got... There's a three-pronged assault. It feels like the... terrorism, for instance, we've got more... It feels like almost every day now. I mean, we're recording... A couple of days after the shooting in Munich by a lone wolf gunman, there has been another suicide bombing in Germany today. On the day we're recording this, a few weeks ago, we had the Nice lorry. It feels like that's not just happening in far off places, it's happening on Europe's front door. And that's one thing. The second is President Trump, which is becoming an increasingly real possibility, which makes me very, very, very scared for civilization. But the catalyst for asking this very nuanced, reasonable question of are we all doomed was there's a report from the OECD, which was out a couple of years ago, which is called Policy Challenges for the Next 50 Years. Now, they see GDP growth being still below pre-crisis levels from now until 2060. It's going to be very, very mediocre. It's going to slow to 2.7% a year by 2060. Now that sounds pretty decent, but really anything below 3% is pretty bad. That was before the crisis, that was considered as a recession worldwide. That sluggish growth, that may still be affected by climate change. Especially in Asia, you could see 5% knocked off GDP by the costs that climate change might affect. In Europe, it might well be 1.5%. So that's also affecting growth. You've also got the fact that we've got an ageing population. We've got fiscal challenges. We've got increasing spending on health. We've got increasing spending on education, especially tertiary education, to try and keep up with the increasing technology that's happening. Also, we have an increasingly ageing population, so more money on pensions as well. And there's a very good chance that if we don't act to stop these fiscal challenges by 2060, developing countries will go bust, essentially. Also, you've got the fact that we're going to have increasing inequality. Now, that's partly because automation and increasing technology, that's going to make a lot of lower skilled jobs redundant. It's going to make a lot of higher skilled jobs as well. You're going to remove any kind of middle class job. Now, the OECD says if that inequality persists, what's going to happen is that an average OECD country now we'll have the same inequality levels as the US by 2060. Now, what that essentially means is you're going to have the same inequality we see in Gary, Indiana at the moment, in the worst bits of the US. We're going to see that kind of inequality in Stockholm, in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, to add on to all of that, what the OECD says we need to do to meet these policy challenges is, well, have more flexible labour markets. Now, we know what that means. That means more zeros contracts. It means more precarious jobs. Also, it says that Europe and the US, we need 50 million more migrants to be absorbed into the economies, to actually be part of the tax base of economies where you've got more ageing population, but also fewer young people because we've got less couples having children. So we need to have 50 million more migrants. Now, that's not politically acceptable at the moment. You know, the rise of Le Pen in France, the rise of the Brexit vote, I don't think that's politically palatable at the moment. So we are doomed, aren't we?
Okay, so for the first time ever on this podcast, I've actually made notes. I'll start off with what I consider to be the easiest one to debunk, which is Trump. So there's two things. So one, let's assume that Trump does win. The thing with Trump winning is based on the assumption that everything that Trump has said he will do, he will do. The thing that we have learned about Trump is that what he has said before bears no relation to what he will say he will do or will in fact do in future. So as much as he's saying we're going to build a wall, we're going to build a wall, we're going to cut off NATO unless they pay their bills or whatever, there's absolutely no guarantee that that is actually the stance he would take. And as much as he's kind of presented himself in much like Brexit as being the anti-expert person, the reality is it's really easy for the Republican nominee to sit there and say, we wouldn't do this and not get any kickback. It's another thing when you've got the Pentagon breathing down your neck and saying, you know, we need to do this. If we don't do this, and this will happen. So that's one.
Okay, so I kind of see that. So almost a bit like the Brexit vote, you have like government bureaucracy and political reality nullifying a lot of what he can do.
Quite potentially, yes.
Okay.
But that's assuming he wins. And the assumption that he wins is... It is possible, but it is not necessary. At this point in time, when we're recording this, it's not probable. 538.com, which if you're interested in American politics, is really, really good because it uses data journalism. And they have a model for working out what the probability is of a Clinton or a Trump win. And of those two, it's something like 65% Clinton, 35% Trump. So the balance of probability based off of the polls, the state of the economy, and the variety of other factors is that Clinton is likely to win at this moment in time. Yes, that could change, but at this moment in time, Clinton is looking like the likely victor. And to put this into a context, which I think is a bit better than saying it's 35% versus 65%, because so many people go, but that's still 35% chance of Trump.
If I was walking home tonight and had a 35% chance of being run over, I'd be quite scared.
Yeah, exactly. But when you look at it in other ways, it becomes a hell of a lot less scary. Hillary Clinton's just chosen Tim Kaine to be her vice presidential pick. Tim Kaine is the governor of Virginia, or a former governor of Virginia, sorry, and a senator from Virginia now. Virginia matters in this election, and whilst generally speaking, you know, vice presidential picks don't swing the states they're from behind the candidate, it can have a marginal effect. Now, currently, based on the polls I was looking at earlier today, Clinton is up by on average about 4% in Virginia. So clearly she's doing quite well. And this is also all before the Democratic convention. If Clinton wins Virginia, then the New York Times have estimated then there's something like 400 different paths to the White House. That for her, that is 400 different combinations of states that she can win to get to the required number of votes in the Electoral College to make a president. If Clinton wins Virginia, Donald Trump has something like 12 or 14. 400 plus routes to power versus 12 based off of one state, a state which Clinton is currently doing very well in. This is not to say that things could go tits up for Clinton, that something could happen, that Trump is able to gain some momentum and overcome his, quite frankly, awful favourable ratings.
Awful ratings which Clinton shares.
Yes, but he's still more he's got higher unfavourables than Clinton does. At the end of the day, it's a two-horse race. You choose the one you like the best. So maybe the country as a whole doesn't like Clinton, but they like her more than they like Trump. But yeah, so Clinton is in a much stronger position, I think, than people actually. Certainly people who don't follow things closely think. I think a lot of British people, for instance, certainly the ones who are massively concerned about Trump, are viewing this in the prism of Brexit, where... Oh my God, we voted for Brexit. Oh my God, that was insane. Oh my God, Trump's insane. Oh my God, the Yanks are the Yanks there.
Trump's got stupid hair. Boris has got stupid hair.
Yeah, the people are drawing comparisons and they've got negative views of what America's like, and they're assuming that because they voted for George W. Bush because he was like he was, that they're going to vote for Trump because he's like a bit like that as well. And it's just not accurate at all. All of the polls, which... aren't accurate, as much as people have been like, oh my God, we can't trust the polls. You can trust the polls. They got the 2015 election wrong, but they got Brexit right. the balance of all the polls said it was a toss-up. It was a 50-50 chance either way. And guess what? It was a 50-50 chance either way, and Brexit won. So the polls were right then. The polls have been proven to be very accurate in the primaries so far.
And
in
actually,
the
they were very
States.
Accurate in 2012. I mean, they still got a lot of stick for going with the polls rather than the popular vote.
Yeah. So with that in mind, I don't think Trump is necessarily going to happen. And even if it does, as I said before, it's not necessarily the complete disaster that people are making it out to be. That's
okay.
Trump.
That makes me feel a bit better, Uncle Steve. Thank you very much. So,
okay. Moving on to the terrorism aspect you've mentioned. So there's a couple of things here. One is a lot of the concern about terrorism is just off of the sheer amount which it seems to appear on our news feeds, on our Facebook and Twitter feeds, and on the news in general. Now, a lot of those things are in Kabul, Egypt, Pakistan, wherever. Just yes, these things are horrific and they are happening, but they have been happening for decades. The amount necessarily of what's happening in those areas hasn't necessarily increased that much. It's just that we're now much more aware of it. Now, that explains part of the concern. In terms of the stuff surrounding stuff which is happening in Europe, there are a couple of different things I'd say to that. One is that compare and contrast Europe as the continent to the UK. The UK has been as forthright in terms of its foreign policy and engaging with stuff, taking part in Libya and participating in things against ISIS, as France has been. France has had multiple attacks. We have had one, really, and that was that I can think of, which was the death of drummer Lee Rigby at the hand of Michael Odiowabi, I think his name was, or something, something like that. But
will we count Joe Cox in this?
I don't know. I mean, this is the thing. I think there's
that terrorism or an assassination.
I think that's a separate thing to look at, which I'll get to in a second. But in terms of like the ISIS-based things, when you look at what's happened in France and what's happened in the UK, it's not like the UK isn't being the target of these things. It's just that we're a hell of a lot better at dealing with them. Part of that is just down to the fact that we've been dealing with the IRA for God knows how many decades, and so we've just got the experience and the benefit of hindsight to know how to deal with a lot of organised sales and things like that.
So we should send Jeremy Corbyn to talk to them. Sorry, I promised I wouldn't.
There is actually a lot of room for improvement in the security services for the continent. Certainly against ISIS-based things. I lose the time ISIS-based loosely, because the vast majority of them aren't actually part of ISIS. They just lay claim to being a representative.
It's kind of more lone wolf type things, whether or not you're a kind of nationalistic gunman or you're driving a van through.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not part of
an
organisation.
It's not an Al-Qaeda cell in the way that it was before. I think the other thing is that ISIS are just very, very good at social media and media management, and they are very good at presenting an image of being all-powerful and kind of being everywhere, when in reality they're not. There was a day a few years back where a number of groups from all across the world, so you've got some in Peru, you've got some in Portugal, you've got some in Egypt and whatever, all in one move on one day, all swore allegiance to the Islamic State. And it made news, because it was like, oh my God, they're getting influence all over the world, we're all doomed, this is problematic. And then you read a piece on somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, and they kind of go, yeah, in a way it's impressive, I suppose, but the actual number of people that have sworn allegiance is less than 200. Because the group that's sworn allegiance in Egypt is a split off from Al-Qaeda, which is also a split off from something else, and there's only about 15 of them, and they're currently engaged in a war with the other Islamic terrorists.
So it's like the People's Front of Judea,
yes,
basically.
Exactly. Okay. And you look at all of these things and you go, ISIS, yeah, they look terrifying, but they're not actually as terrifying as they seem. Their bark is a lot worse than their bite. In terms of foreign nations, you know, if you're actually in ISIS-controlled lands, then that's a completely different ball game. But in terms of the threat to Europe and the United States, no, they're not actually as big a threat as that. The other issue you raised was obviously the aspect of Joe Cox's death, and I think with this you can bring in the Munich
atrocity that happened a few days ago, which wasn't an act of Islamic extremism. It was a kind of Breivik-style nut job, right-wing nut job.
Bullied at school.
And I think with those kind of things, it's you need to adopt a completely different approach. One is actually taking those threats seriously and actually investigating those kind of groups as the threats that they clearly are. But and I think it's just certainly in the continent as well, it boils down to kind of just paying a bit more attention to these things. And again, it's just linked to wider failures in their security services.
Okay.
So again, for Britain, at least, not the end of the world.
Let me make a note. So don't go on holiday
to Europe. Right, so for the OECD stuff, I'm going to take the income inequality off of the back of automation as the kind of the primary thing, because I think this is the one I'm aware of the most, and I think it feeds into the ageing population one for certain, and potentially even the migration block. There is a move towards kind of automation, and the notion that there is that this is going to create mass joblessness. That as we get more self-service checkouts, Tesco is going to need less people to work their average checkouts. And as such, they're going to let people go. And yeah, there's a lot of logic behind that. But at the same time, what you need to remember is that those self-service checkouts require maintenance. So they're still going to need someone to look after them. So their jobs will be created in the maintenance of those things. So yes, those people then need to be retrained, and governments should be doing a hell of a lot more in that, and should have been doing a hell of a lot more for that for decades. But it's not the end of the world. The other thing to take into account with this is that with any kind of shift in major shift in the kind of the world's economy, whether it be the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, or globalization, there are always periods where there's a transition that happens, and those transitions can be a bit painful. Certainly for a certain type of people. But after the bulk of it, people moved, people changed, people adapted. Now, again, maybe the governments haven't always done the best as they could have done in helping people adapt and change. Maybe people did fall through the cracks. In fact, absolutely they did fall through the cracks. But when we industrialised agriculture, yes, people lost their jobs. Yes, there was some hardship. But as a country, well, we managed to get to the point where we're automating more jobs. So things progressed and things changed, but we adapted. Humans are nothing if not versatile. And also, what you often find is there's a delay between the economic growth, which occurs off the back of these kind of economic changes, such as the Industrial Revolution, and that growth being passed down to regular people. So whilst at the moment, with globalisation and marketing automation, you might be seeing this inequality with everything going up to the top, it's because it's new. As time goes on, as things adapt and change, future generations, in a lot of ways, we're kind of like the worst generation to be in to take advantage of this, because we've just missed out on being able to get the proper coding training at school or something like that, so that we could go in to be developers or something like that. You know, if you're able to prevent that in income inequality by giving people the skills that they need, which is absolutely feasible and possible, then you're going to have more money to spend on the things that are required for the aging population. So it's still going to be tight. There's only so many things you can do to make that work, but you know it won't be as bad. So it's not all doom and gloom in relation to that. Now the migration block. Is another thing which is interesting, because I'd be really interested to know if the impact of automation has been taken into account with the requirement for migration, because a lot of the people that are coming into the country for this kind of mass scale migration are low skilled workers, which with automation there will be fewer need for.
Honestly, I can't remember. I think the point with the migration is often it's to increase the tax block that a lot of these countries get. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a declining birth rate in Britain, and so migrants are a good way of increasing your tax base.
Yes,
so
but if they're coming in and they've got work to do, which 99% of them do, then you know that holds true. But if you're assuming that, for instance, the automation occurs and there's fewer of those low skilled jobs available, then the only ones who are going to be coming over here and working are going to be high skill. Now that presents actually a whole load of other challenges around birth rate and potentially linking to the aging population. But you know, it doesn't mean it means it means that you don't necessarily need the exact number that they're quoting there.
Also, a lot of the growth is predicated on free trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to have a talk about open borders. I don't want to talk about free trade. We can do that in the next series. But I don't think the political will is there to have open borders and free trade. Looking at the movement for Trump, looking at the Brexit movement, I don't think the political will, the popular will, is there to have those policies, even to have the sluggish economic growth that the OECD says we'd have.
Okay, I think there are a couple of things you need to take into account there. So you've mentioned Trump, and I think you mentioned the Front National. In France, where everybody's expecting the Front National to get into the final two and potentially even win the presidency, what we're seeing after the result of the Brexit vote is a spike in pro-EU feeling. And this is happening across a lot of the EU.
Mm. That's ironic, isn't it? The Brexit vote might be the one thing that keeps the EU together.
Yeah. When it comes to freedom of movement, people are going to be willing to potentially accept that as a price to pay for the wider good that they see that the EU does. It's a balance of net benefit and net negatives. And they'll, based on the spike in membership, potentially at the moment, you're more likely to see them falling towards it, the EU being a net positive. Now, from my point of view, I think the best outcome will always be freedom of movement and freedom of capital and a globalised economy, just because that's where I think growth comes from. Other people do not agree with me on that, and that's fine. But it would not be the end of the world. It would not be all doom and gloom if we were to have that kind of situation arise, in my opinion.
Okay, the one thing we haven't talked about is climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not a danger that while we're talking about all this and we manage to ward off fascism in France and America and somehow introduce some sort of negative income tax and reduce automation, that the planet just cooks?
Okay, so I'm going to say some things in here which are going to be very unpopular. One is frack, baby, frack. That is actually one of the best ways you can actually achieve of reducing carbon emissions, because the gas you get from that is cleaner than a lot of the things we're burning. So you would effectively be able to reduce that quite substantially. The other thing is, we are entering a point where a lot of renewables are on the cusp of actually being quite effective. We are now hitting up the point where, you know, entire days, you know, something like 30% of the grid is being powered by solar power. Now, that's not necessarily as stunning as it sounds, but it's the first time we've ever done that. So there are lots of ways that we are making improvements in these kind of fields. I mean, I'm a great believer in that necessity is the mother of invention. And one of the reasons we haven't actually gotten to the point where these things are being developed rapidly, although they are starting to be there now. Just look at the electric cars that we're producing. Just look at the advances in solar panel technology, where you're now able to produce solar roadways, literally roads which are just tapped into the grid to enable to power it. You know, these things are happening and they are here, and it's just a case of getting them out there and getting to the point where they are more affordable to happen.
Okay, so in terms of the fracking thing, as I understand it...
I knew you were going to pull me up on this one.
Oh, yes. I've been reading books, you know. I have my facts. Fracking produces more methane when you're excavating, when you're extracting the gas, when you're storing it, and when you're transporting it. And it releases more methane into the atmosphere. Now, methane is a much more polluting gas than CO2. I think it's like 30-odd more times more polluting. So I don't think fracking is the answer. I mean, both from a CO2 point of view, but also from the point of view of, we have finite resources. There's a finite amount of coal and gas and oil, and at some point we need to stop getting stuff out of the ground.
Absolutely, I agree with all of that. At some point we do need to stop taking stuff out of the ground. But the problem is, you know, what are we going to replace it with?
So at the moment, as you say, there's more renewables. It's a case of having the political will to do it. I mean, you can see in Germany and Scandinavia, there's that political will. There's more of a move to renewables there. I think Germany has got 25-30% of its renewable.
And yet they're still not hitting those targets.
They're not, no. Not
the only country which is coming close in terms of Europe is France, because they're using nuclear power. Nuclear power is the other option, but that when as soon as you discuss that, the very people who are concerned about climate change tend to get turned massively off and go, "Oh no, we couldn't do that."
Nuclear power is a halfway house. I think it's better than fracking.
Yeah, it may very well be a stopgap,
but okay,
it's a necessary one if climate change is a serious issue, which I think it is. And if there is a potential that it can have massive impacts by 2060, as the OECD might suggest it does, then why are we waiting for the perfect solution to come around when it's not here yet, when we could do something which works? That's what I don't get when it comes to nuclear power. Yeah, it's not ideal, but it's a damn slight better than burning coal and gas.
I think the other thing in terms of waiting for things to come along is that what happens is, especially kind of the fossil fuel companies, energy companies, if you leave them to their own devices, what I think they do is, rather than invest in renewable technology, I think they tend to go into things like fracking, go into stuff like excavating the tar sands or drilling under the Arctic ice for more gas, which is more polluting. It's profitable for them, but is still more polluting. So I think it's about having the political will to try and invest in that green technology.
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. And there are certainly a number of government and policy initiatives that you could put in place, and I think some places have put in place, to help try and deal with that sort of stuff. But it is about political will to do so.
Shall we leave it there?
I think that's probably a good place to leave it.
And this is the end of our first series. It's been a very boring 3 months. Nothing really has happened in the world.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know what we're going to find to talk about next series. but we're going to take a bit of a break, mainly because I'm going to go off and get married.
And I'm going to ritualistically character assassinate him at the wedding.
It's going to be very easy, I think. So look out for us. We'll be hopefully writing some blogs over the summer, and we'll also be back at some point in September with some more ideas. So thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed it, please subscribe on iTunes. Please Facebook us and tweet us and send that. Spread the word. That'd be really much appreciated.
Yeah, you can tweet me at Centre Radical.
And I'm at Paperback Rioter. Thank you for listening, and see you in September.
Bye.
Moving from coal burning to fracking seems a bit like saying, well, we need to cut down on my cigarette smoking, so let's start smoking cigars instead.
Still healthier for you. just scientifically speaking. Just pointing that out.
Just
you don't inhale all the way with a cigar.
I'm gonna edit that without